The race to the South Pole ended over a century ago when a team led by Roald Amundsen planted a Norwegian flag at the world's southern tip. Today, two men are attempting to complete the failed expedition of Robert Scott, whose Terra Nova expedition came in second and then tragically perished on the return voyage. Anthony Goddard is a software developer for Encyclopedia of Life and founder of 060.org and TEDx Woods Hole. He's also the science lead for the new Scott expedition, and he joins me now. Anthony, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
So the original Terra Nova South Pole team, as I understand it, consisted of 16 men. They had motorized sledges, they had horses, they had dogs. The new Scott expedition is two men, their skis, and sleds.
Right.
Why?
So the original expedition actually went for a few years. They had a whole summer before they went to the pole, where they were they did a number of scientific studies, and then they did some winter journeys as well. So they did... They wanted to collect penguin embryos during the winter. They could only get to this particular place in the winter. And then during the next summer, they went to the pole. So it was actually going to the pole for the original Scott expedition was the almost like an afterthought for the expedition.
It was kind of the icing on the cake.
Right.
So it wasn't, I mean, that wasn't the main goal, even though there was this kind of heated race to get there.
Right.
And in the end, they came in second.
Correct.
All right, so the guys that are on the ice right now, they've been there for about three weeks. So how is the expedition going so far?
Pretty good. So they're, I think they're about 175 miles into the expedition right now. They have another 1,615 miles to go. So this will be the first expedition that actually gets to the pole and then all the way back. There's been expeditions before that have made it to the pole, but nobody's come all the way back to repeat what Captain Scott did. They've found the weather. You can have a look on their blog. They've found the weather pretty trying for the first few weeks. And I think you can, if you look back at the stories told for the original expedition, you can see that there's days where even if you're 50 miles away from another party, the weather can be completely different. So it could be calm on one side and then basically a hurricane on the other side of the ice shelf.
So we should say that that blog is scottexpedition.com, and you can find a link to that from our website, capeandislands.org, also some photos there. So this is just even being in Antarctica and actually skiing is kind of the second or third leg of this trip already. I mean, I have been following the blog a little bit, and there was first to Chile and then to South Georgia Island, right? I mean, so they've been kind of working their way down there gradually. How long have they been underway in total?
Right. So I suppose the correct answer for that would be 10 years. They've spent 10 years planning the expedition, and if you ask Ben, his answer would be that most of the hard work he feels was done, well, before he left, most of the hard work he thought had been done by the time they left because of all that work in getting sponsorships and planning the logistics.
They also did a lot of training in Greenland, right?
Right, yeah. So we did training in Greenland back in the spring. So the guys... this was the first journey they'd been on together, so they wanted to make sure that everything worked out well in the tent, but also wanted to test the communications equipment as well.
So that actually raises then your role in this. So this is expected to be about a four-month journey to the pole and back, and they're doing, I guess, just being two men in sleds, kind of a stripped-down version. They don't have that whole year and extra summer that you were
right.
talking about that the original Scott expedition had for science, but... They are doing some science, and I wonder how you got involved in this project originally.
So I've known Ben for 8 or 9 years, and I got in contact with him originally through one of his North Pole expeditions. And then back in 2011, I met up with his expedition manager in London for a coffee just to talk about Arctic things, kind of nerd out about the idea of doing big expeditions. And then a few months after that, they called me up and said, hey, we're going to do this thing. It looks like it's actually going to happen now. Would you like to do the science stuff? And since that day, so there's been a lot of work I've done to try to put together a science program, but there's also an amazing amount of computer programming and just like technical work and the communication stuff that I've sort of found myself in a position where I can help with that stuff too. So it's been pretty busy for the last couple of years.
So what is it about the combination of adventure, exploration, just this, you know, getting to the pole and back kind of because it's their aspect of things, but then combining that with scientific research, what is it about that combination that really appeals to you?
So for me, it's the idea of collecting data. So these people are doing amazing things, going places that people haven't been before or doing things that people haven't done before. And so I feel like there's a pretty good chance that they're going to find things that people haven't found before, or at least be able to do experiments that weren't possible before. So my interest in these things is if somebody's rowing a boat across the Atlantic, for example, can we stick some sensors on that boat and can we get some data from that row? Or if somebody's walking to the South Pole or those type of things. I think it's just really cool, the idea that they're there anyway. Is there something that they can do that we can share with the world that will provide back some data that we wouldn't have previously had?
I mean, don't researchers go to the South Pole sometimes anyway, but I guess by helicopter or other motorized vehicle? Is there something special or unique about the fact that they're skiing there from a science, from a research perspective?
So that was definitely the hope that there would be. And that kind of exemplifies the problem of finding an experiment that works, because obviously there's humongous logistical challenges to any science that's done on an expedition like this. So the originally what we looked at doing was just recording meteorological data, which is exactly what they did 100 years ago. And then we looked at what could we do that scientists may be able to do elsewhere but can't do just by skiing. I'll go through the list again. Yeah.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. I want to actually go back. How much did you know about the original Scott expedition when you got in touch with Ben and his team and started talking about doing this?
Yeah, that's another interesting part. So since I was a kid, I've really loved the idea of going to the furthest place you can get to. I remember traveling to the US 7 or 8 years ago, and we looked at Cape Cod, and we didn't know what Cape Cod was, but we thought it was the furthest away from like New York City. We'd get right up to the tip of Provincetown. I've always been interested in Antarctica and Arctic exploration, kind of as an armchair explorer, obviously. But in this case, I realized there was a lot of background that I needed on the expedition. So since I was asked to do the science stuff, I've been studying a lot of books and looking at films and all the data from back in the day.
So you said armchair explorer. You've never been to Antarctica yourself?
No, I wish.
Yeah, you would like to go?
Yeah, I'd love to.
All right. So you've been doing all this learning about the original Scott expedition. And so let's talk a little bit more about what they actually did. I mean, they had a year down there. 100 years ago, this was basically completely unexplored territory. So what was some of the science that they did?
So some of the really big ticket items were studies into terrestrial magnetism. So back then, the British decided that some of the information that was kind of missing in their science work, and also there were other Europeans that were working in it as well, was magnetic recordings from the South Pole, or as close to the South Pole as possible. And if they could get those recordings, then they would be able to sort of piece together a better picture of the magnetic field, the Earth's magnetic field. So that was a huge one. And just the general climate research that they did down there. So they had a weather station. No matter what the weather was, George Simpson, the meteorologist, had to walk out there every morning at the same time, exactly the same time, and tweak the instruments.
And then they also did this kind of wild expedition, as you said, winter expedition, to get to Cape Crozier, yeah, to a penguin population there, and to bring back eggs. What was the purpose of that?
So in the Discovery expedition, which was the preceding expedition to the Terra Nova expedition, they had seen a penguin rookery at Cape Crozier, and there was a scientist on the Terra Nova expedition who wanted to collect some eggs to do embryo research. So three guys set out on an expedition in the middle of winter. I think they were about 40 days out. They got to Cape Crozier. They realized they couldn't get to the rookery. They had to literally like hack steps into the ice to climb down cliffs to get to the penguins. Then once they got there, they realized there weren't anywhere near as many penguins as there had been earlier, which was a scientific result in itself. Mm-hmm. They collected 5 eggs. And then on the way back, one of them was actually nearsighted and he couldn't use his glasses in Antarctica because they kept fogging up. So he slipped a couple of times and he dropped 2 of the eggs on the way back.
Oh, no.
They got back to their camp, which they built an igloo against the side of a cliff, and they pitched their tent outside, and basically a hurricane blew through. The tent blew away in the middle of the night. It was the middle of the night the whole time because it was winter. And then the roof collapsed in the wind. So they thought they were gone, obviously, and they went looking for the tent the next morning. They found it half a mile away, and it had actually, because it had accumulated so much ice, it hadn't fallen too far away, so they made it through. They came all the way back with the eggs, and the idea was they could prove a link between reptiles and birds back then. Was the
so this was essentially evolutionary biology research that they were doing just after the turn of the century.
And to make so, Apsley Cherry Garrard, one of the guys on that expedition, wrote a book called The Worst Journey in the World in the 1920s that details the whole expedition and the Terra Nova expedition. And in it, one of the crazy parts is he actually himself goes to the National History Museum in London to hand over the eggs at the end of the expedition. And the chief curator who he meets with doesn't realize who he is and doesn't have any time for him at all. So he's waiting there with these eggs to give to this guy. And he hands them to him and the guy just kind of fobs him off.
So, I mean, they would have been dead embryos by that point, right. Presumably.
Right. And it turned out, I don't know the exact research that they did on the eggs. They went back a few years. He went back a few years later to find out what had happened, and they actually couldn't find the eggs. So he was a bit more frustrated about how much time they spent trying to get the eggs. And then there was other research in the meantime that basically disproved what they were looking at, I think.
So, I mean, when you're in a place like Antarctica and doing this kind of exploration, obviously there are going to be mishaps and misadventures, but the Scott expedition from start to finish seems to be almost cursed, yeah. and has had a reputation over the years as being a bit perhaps misguided.
Mm-hmm.
In reading about it, do you get that sense? And in terms of the science that they were doing, was this just kind of crazy ideas, or was this really the best science they could be doing at that point?
I think it was definitely the best science they could be doing at that time. Some of the mishaps, so the Modus sledges, they brought three Modus sledges. Along they brought ponies. So Amundsen just had dogs. I think he had 90-something dogs that he took along. And the Modus sledges turned out to be a complete disaster. They were not much use from the day they landed. Actually, one of them sank through the ice just after they took it off the boat when they got there. I guess the flip side of that is there was atrocious weather conditions that they experienced on the way on their southern journey. And so Susan Solomon, the author, has gone back and looked at data from the original expedition and from data that's been collected since to find out what sort of conditions they experienced or what they were likely to experience and how that might have affected the conditions.
I mean, of course, they didn't have any modern weather forecasting right. like we have, they would have had no idea.
And surprisingly, we have, so in the 80s, the 70s and 80s, there was automatic weather stations set up that basically follow the same route that Captain Scott walked. And that was the University of Wisconsin. I think the Navy has some equipment that sends back automated weather reports. But even that equipment, after it was installed, didn't last in the conditions. There's some of those units are working, some of them aren't, and they're going to replace a bunch. But the guys actually just skied past one the other day, and it was broken.
And you said they're replacing them as they go?
I think University of Wisconsin upgrading the units to deal with the conditions better.
Right.
But so it's actually, that's one of the problems for us right now is we're taking weather recordings on the expedition and we want to correlate them with what we know are accurate recordings from the weather stations along the route. But we can't get that data live because it has to go through a lot of processing. And then in some cases, the data doesn't exist because the machines are down.
So you've just got a lot of data processing and as you said earlier, communications technology issues that you're trying to deal with.
Right.
Now, in terms of the fact that these guys are skiing totally under their own power. I mean, that's in part, I would guess, a result of rules that are now in place. You're not allowed to have dogs or horses or other animals, right?
Yeah, I don't know what the rules are on dogs and horses, but you can certainly have kites. And I mean, people, there have been crazy expeditions to the South Pole, like people driving big trucks or bikes. Well, bikes is cooler than big trucks. I don't really get the big trucks thing at all.
And kites, you mean like literally you'd be skiing with a big kite to pull you along?
Yep.
Was that considered?
No. So Scott actually, I believe at some point, did use kites to help with some of the loads. So one of the key things with the current expedition is that it's completely unsupported. So you can't use, it has to be all human powered and you can't get resupplied from anywhere. Everything, all the fuel and the food that you need, you have to take with you. So they're kind of going along those sort of polar exploration unsupported rules.
So if successful, this will be the longest unsupported polar expedition in history.
Right. Yep. By a long shot.
The Terra Nova expedition to the South Pole has long been viewed as a tragedy. Robert Scott's team reached the South Pole, but they were beat there by a Norwegian team and then all perished on the return trip. One thing did survive the expedition, and that's the science they conducted along the way. Now two men are in Antarctica attempting to complete the Terra Nova expedition, and they're replicating some of the original explorers' scientific observations. I'm talking with Anthony Goddard, science lead for the Scott expedition. Anthony, how important has Scott's research and those original observations proved to be over the past century?
So the terrestrial magnetism studies were incredibly valuable, even at the time and since. And as well, so the Terra Nova hut was built to conduct a bunch of experiments from, and they were there for 2 years. I'm pretty sure it was 2 years. And so they were able to record the longest continuous period of atmospheric climate condition measurements at the time. So that was incredibly valuable since as well.
So Ben and Tucker are down there now and replicating some of these weather observations. Are they using essentially the same technology, or are they using new technology? And if so, how do you correlate those two sets of data?
So that's some of the challenges that we've had. So they're using new technology to collect the data. And even some... So we went through exactly the measurements that were taken back in the day and how they took them. And some of it... is a little bit redundant now, but also some of the calculations have changed. So the way you calculated wind chill back in 1911 is different than the way you calculate wind chill in 2013.
Really? Why?
I'm not actually sure. It's an extremely complicated formula, but I guess they came up with a formula. It's actually different in different countries as well. So I think the US and Europe use one system, and Asian countries use different systems.
Depends on how hardy you are, maybe.
Right. And so, what we're going to need to do is calculate the wind chill as what it is right now, and then also calculate it as if it was 1911 and compare it to the measurements they took back then.
So they were keeping these records on paper, obviously no digital technology back then, and you actually found a copy of the original expedition logs here in Woods Hole in the MBL's archives. Right. How did that come about?
So... I realized that in order to obviously replicate the same studies, we need to find the data. And I went looking online, and I found a scan that was done by the Internet Archive. And it was done by NOAA. And so I looked at it up on the NOAA servers, and then I found another copy of it that pointed to the MBL Hui Library. And I was like, wow. And I came into work, and I went to a guy at the library, and I said, hey, do you have this book? And he went out, grabbed it, brought it back. And I was like, is it in the rare books collection or something? He's like, nope. And I was like, can I check it out? He's like, yep. So I could grab that, and it was sitting on my desk. It's been sitting on my desk since then. And it's pretty cool, because when we've been working on expedition things, I'm able to just to like reach over and grab this thing, this book, the first edition from 1920, and open it up and find the records that I'm looking for.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And you've been working to digitize these so that presumably you can do better comparisons between the new data and the old. But how's that effort going?
Yeah, so the original data, some of the data has been digitized already, which is the ocean meteorological conditions. But the actual southern journey to the South Pole, that data, as far as I can tell, I've emailed a lot of people to try to find it. I haven't been able to find it. So what we decided to do was set up a crowdsourcing website that people can go to, and they can, if they have a few minutes, they can just type in a record, and then we just make sure that if enough people say the same temperature for the same time, then that's the temperature that was recorded.
Yeah, so we should say, I mean, you can take photos of the pages to do a quick digitization, but that doesn't give you data that you
exactly,
can actually work with. So this needs to be manually every number entered so that it can can be a database to work with.
And then we're hoping that will make sort of some of the scientific legacy from this expedition will be the availability of that data as well. So if somebody else is in my position looking for it, then they can just find it quickly on Google instead of have to transcribe it all.
So what kind of comparisons are planned when this expedition is complete to between the two sets of data?
So what we've decided to do is basically get the data and then make it available, and then let scientists kind of come in, and they can see exactly how we got the data. They can see exactly the technology we used and everything. But there's a lot of complicated issues in making a scientific statement out of it, and a lot of work has been done in the last 100 years around that exact around the question of how accurate the original data was, and what sort of like errors they might have had based on the temperatures and the equipment and that type of thing. So at the moment, unless the scientist comes along and says, here's a hypothesis I have, our plan is to put that data out there.
So you're just doing this and kind of if we build it, they will come is right. the hope, right? That
and
if you put the
like,
data out there.
We can look at things that might seem reasonably obvious on the surface, like what was the coldest day that they had? But in order to say it was colder in 2013 than 1911, for example, it is a lot more complicated than I originally thought.
Well, and of course, even if you say that, it doesn't necessarily, you know, translate into it's colder now than it was then in terms of a climate sense, right? Because it's two snapshots. You've got an issue there where you're just comparing two distinct times. You don't have a whole trend set there. Or something.
So on the winter journey, they recorded temperatures of negative 77 degrees. And there was some discussion, or there has been discussion since that it was impossible for it to be that cold, or the equipment had problems.
I would think anything would have problems at minus 77.
Yeah. But since there was actually a year, I think in the early 80s, there was a year that was recorded where the temperatures did get down as close as bad as was reported in 1911.
Wow. Now, I know that you and the team contemplated a lot of science in addition to these meteorological observations that are being taken. It's a long list. And most of that had to be eliminated, I guess, because of weight concerns, because obviously these guys are hauling everything themselves. But I wonder if you could tell us what some of the science was that you considered you wanted to do.
Yeah, so that was kind of the unfortunate part. So one thing I should just quickly say is that the current expedition, the 200 kilos they're carrying is almost double what anyone carried on the original expedition. So to put some perspective on just how hard it is to put additional weight in the sleds for science. So not only they're not just going to be repeating what Scott did, but they're going to have a much tougher job of hauling the sleds. We had a lot of ideas in the beginning about different science that we could do. And then basically we just went through the list and everything. We would get up to a certain point with every experiment, and then there would be a logistical problem with going forward with it. One of the cooler ones, which is actually one of the original ones, or crazier ones, I should say, I actually contemplated, because this is one of the first ones, I contemplated not telling the team about it because they just asked me to be the science guy and I thought they'd probably fire me for coming with a suggestion. But we had a prominent scientist who came to us and said, what you could do is if it's an unsupported expedition, so we can't resupply the guys, would it count if we did airdrops of explosives? And I said, go on. And he said, what we could do is pre-position explosives along the way. The guys could carry a small seismometer. They could detonate the explosives and then take readings to understand the terrain underneath them. So obviously with the snow and the pressure ridges and the glaciers, there's a lot of crevasses and everything's kind of hidden below the surface, obviously. So there were a number of reasons we couldn't do that.
It seems like safety would be a big issue there.
Yeah, we definitely didn't want to blow the sleds up or not be able to find the explosives. But that was probably the coolest one. up there with the cool ones, we had an offer of some ex-military UAVs that had been sort of converted into science UAVs that we could fly around. And the idea was to attach chemical sensors to them and fly them around Mount Erebus for atmospheric profiling work. And they were quite lightweight, as you can imagine, but not lightweight enough. And then there were some much more simple ones. So one of the ideas we were positive was going to make it was just attach meteorological instruments onto the sleds and then have continuous reporting 24 hours a day. The data just gets sent back. And that was a go up until the point where when we did the training in Greenland, we discovered that the communication system that they were going to use wasn't going to work. There was no way they could get the data back from Antarctica with enough bandwidth. So they had to get a marine satellite radio and then customize it, make it as lightweight as possible to put it on the sleds for their standard communication work. And that kind of kicked off the data logger equipment that we were going to have, which was about the same weight.
I mean, they are obviously communicating. They're posting blog reports. You can, on the website, see at least daily, perhaps not to the minute, current weather conditions. So you guys did figure out some of that technological issue.
So we're getting the weather data back, and there's some work we still have to do to make that a bit more live. So at the moment we have the temperature, but it's sort of an estimate from different sources. But we do actually have the recordings from the guys. So we're working to build that into the website and make that actually live, which will be really cool. And that will have all the same measurements that were taken in 1911.
So how does all of this work that you're doing, I mean, you know, you said you've gotten into kind of being the tech support as well as the science coordinator for the expedition. How does that fit in with your day job?
So there are some interesting parallels. So one example is we had a satellite tracking provider that we were going to use for the expedition, but it turned out their tracker weighed a couple of hundred grams more than a competing tracker. So we decided 2 weeks before the expedition started to switch to the competing tracker. And that involved just talking to the company and finding out how we could access their data. And it turned out they had no way to access the data live. So we were in a bit of trouble because we needed to know, I mean, especially where the guys were, if for nothing else, but just safety. And so I had to write a script basically that automatically logged in to the provider's website and then automatically filled out a form and downloaded the data and then stored it in a database for us. And once we did that, the provider thought they were being hacked. So they actually shut down all of our access to the tracking software, which was a bit of a stressful weekend. But so there's little things like that. And there's no way that guys, I think, could have predicted that stuff. And so it's kind of just coincidental that I'm on board and that's stuff that I do in my day job.
So what about the possibility of doing some climate change research while they're down there?
So I suppose that just goes back to the data that we're able to collect, those daily meteorological observations.
I mean, some of the other projects that you guys looked at, though, would have been other, they were proposed by climate scientists,
yeah,
who thought this was a great opportunity to add to their research.
Right, yeah. So one of those was a study into carbon in the snow and the reflectivity of the snow and the grain size. And the problem with that particular experiment was the size of the vessels that we needed to use to collect the snow without impacting it by the collection was too great. So the weight was too much in that case, but also the empty containers were too big. So
I mean, given all of these weight considerations, and then obviously, as you're saying, that the fact that a lot of these experiments would have required additional training for these two guys who have already spent 10 years training and fundraising, mm-hmm, and preparing for this mission, was there ever any thought of just scrapping the science and just skiing to the pole and back?
The hope was if we could find a meaningful experiment, it had to be something that actually provided some value, that we should do it to sort of pay respect to that. That's why they did it 100 years ago. But also because if we're there and we can do it, then we should do it.
I mean, is that something that from the very beginning of this expedition, I guess that was kind of at the backbone of the original Scott expedition. It's what made it unique. In addition, of course, to the tragedy, but
right,
is kind of its positive legacy going forward. So was that really kind of at the backbone of this new expedition?
I'd say for sure this new expedition is, here's this thing, this challenge that has never been completed. That's first and foremost. And then secondary to that, if we can do some science, then let's try to get something done.
All right. So how is it going so far in terms of the technology? That is it working? Are you getting the observations that you hoped?
Yeah. So the technology has been working great since the beginning of the expedition. That's mostly from the lessons that we learned in Greenland. But even up until the actual day they left, there were technical problems. So there was technical problems with the customized gear. So this is the marine satellite system. Customized the way it is the only one in the world. So if they have problems with it, they're in a bit of trouble. And they actually did have problems just before leaving London, and it was too late to do anything before they shipped it to Chile. So they had to ship this unit to Chile, and then they had to ship it back to North Carolina to get worked on, and then back to Chile before they made it to Antarctica. But thankfully, now that it's there, everything's fine.
Anthony Goddard is the science lead for the Scott expedition, currently in Antarctica. Anthony, thank you.